the theory side to explain what supersymmetry is and what the motivations are, and I'll briefly describe a toy model and then how you proceed from a toy model to a realistic model, namely supersymmetric gauge theories, which would be something that would include the standard model but additional symmetries as well. And that will take me up to supersymmetry breaking. Tomorrow I will cover supersymmetry models, including the MSSM, supergravity, and grand unified theories. And we'll aim towards making a connection with experiment here. So to get started, I want to first mention the standard model of particle physics. As Tanabashi has explained, this is based on the gauge symmetry SU3 of color cross SU2 of weak isospin cross U1 of weak hypercharge, and it gives rise to the gluons, the W and B gauge bosons. And the matter contents are three generations of quarks and leptons, left and right hand fermions. And in the Higgs sector, we add a doublet of complex scalars and arrange the Higgs potential such that spontaneous electroweak symmetry breaking can occur. And this gives rise to the massive W and Z bosons along with a massless photon and massive quarks and leptons. The Lagrangian of the theory has four parts, the gauge Lagrangian, the matter Lagrangian, the Yukawa couplings, and the Higgs potential. And within that Lagrangian, you have 19 parameters, most of which are highly constrained by data, so you can tune them to match data. And it's been traditional in many years past to say that the model gives a good to excellent description of almost all accelerator data. However, in the past few years, well, 5 to 30 years, depending on how you're counting, many chinks have arisen in the standard model, and it's clear nowadays that the standard model does not describe a wide variety of additional data. Namely, there's in the past 7 years, there have been definitive data coming in that neutrinos, in fact, have masses and mixings, and this is not described in the standard model. There's also the a variety of other astrophysical data, namely baryogenesis, if you want to explain the matter-antimatter asymmetry in the context of the Big Bang, then you cannot do this in the framework of the standard model, and you'll need additional physics beyond the standard model to explain that matter-antimatter asymmetry. In addition, the data indicating a variety of cosmological data has been accrued, indicating that there's cold, dark matter in the universe, and in fact, the particles of the standard model don't even make up the bulk of the matter in the universe. And so there has to be some other type of matter, probably some neutral elementary, massive elementary particle left over from the Big Bang. And then finally, a big surprise in the past few years is that the universe is filled up with a dark energy that is causing an acceleration in the expansion of the universe. And this, of course, also is not explained in the standard model. Now, along with the data that is not described by the standard model, there's a variety of theoretical problems with the standard model. First of all, there is a scalar sector. I said there's a scalar, a doublet of scalars in the standard model. If we calculate radiative corrections to any sort of quantities involving these scalars, you get what are called quadratic divergences. And these give rise to, since the standard model is renormalizable, you can still deal with these, but they give rise to something called fine-tuning. Standard model doesn't explain the origin of generations, why the masses are of the particles that they are, and doesn't explain the origin of the gauge symmetry or the quantum numbers of the fermions in theory. And it would be nice to have some sort of unification with gravity. Now, what I want to do, first of all, is mention the problem of scalar quadratic divergences in the standard model, because that seems to indicate that there ought to be some sort of new physics at the trillion electron volt scale. If I were to go ahead and calculate the Higgs mass in the standard model, I would get a three-level mass, but then there should also be contributions, loop contributions such as these, which will give additional corrections to the Higgs boson mass. If I were to calculate the correction just from this diagram, I'd have to insert the standard model interaction. This would be the four Higgs interaction that would get inserted here. And then you'd have to annihilate and create the Higgs in the initial and final state. And if you go ahead and calculate this thing, you'd have to do the contractions of this field with the initial and final particles, and then two of these get contracted into a Higgs propagator. And so you're left with this loop integral over d4k divided by the Higgs boson propagator, and this has 4 powers of k in the numerator and 2 powers of k in the denominator. Of course, in quantum mechanics, you have to integrate over all intermediate states, so you integrate over all momentum values. And the calculation turns out to be divergent. So the divergence could be regulated, for instance, by an ultraviolet cutoff on the upper end of this integral, which is usually called lambda. And if you do the integral, then this lambda is explicitly displayed here, and you get something that goes like lambda squared, and plus other corrections that go like log of lambda. Now, if you go ahead and calculate the physical Higgs boson mass, the physical Higgs boson mass, which Tanabashi has told us ought to be less than 200 GeV, is going to be the standard model three-level Higgs boson mass plus this radiative correction, which will be a constant times lambda squared. So if we thought that maybe the standard model should be a valid theory all the way from the weak scale up to the scale of grand unification, then this upper cutoff would have to be up around 10 to the 16th GeV, and you'd have to plug in 10 to the 16th square to get 10 to the 32, and if you would have to dial in a three-level mass here, that would have to be fine-tuned to one part in 10 to the 26 in order to cancel off this divergence, in order to get something that's less than 200 GeV over here. And that is an extreme fine-tuning that people seem to indicate, well, it seems to indicate the standard model isn't likely to be the story all the way up to 10 to the 16th GeV. Alternatively, if you want no fine-tuning, then you'd want to take this parameter lambda to be of order of the weak scale, for instance, a TeV, and then you could plug in, and then you would get no fine-tuning. You'd get a 200 GeV scale Higgs mass here, and this would all balance out just fine, but then you're admitting tacitly that lambda is 1 TeV and the standard model is only valid up to that energy scale, and then you have to have new physics. Now, in order to solve this problem, one way to solve it is to invoke a new type of symmetry called supersymmetry. Well, it's only new since about 1974. Let me tell you what supersymmetry is in case you're getting started in this field. It turns out supersymmetry is a space-time symmetry. You might be familiar with quantum field theory, that there are the symmetries of rotations, translations in space and time, and boosts, and all together these symmetries make up what's called the Poincaré group, which is the symmetry that underlies relativistic quantum field theory. It turns out that if you make the most general extension of the Poincaré group that we know about, you get what's called the super Poincaré group, which includes supersymmetry, and supersymmetry is somehow an additional space-time symmetry. It turns out to be a quantum symmetry, that is, it has no classical analog. The rotations, boosts, and translations all have our classical type of symmetries, but the supersymmetry is not. In fact, it has a what's called a spinorial generator, Q, in its group theory structure, and Q, basically, if it operates on a state with bosons in it, you get back a state with fermions, and if Q acts on a fermion state, you get back bosons. So supersymmetry ends up relating bosons to fermions. And if you look at the group theory structure of this thing, it turns out that it's effectively a square root of a translation, in that if you make two supersymmetry transformations, you would take a boson to a fermion, then the fermion back to the boson, but in the process you would get a translation. So it's quite an interesting symmetry. It was actually discovered gradually over a period of several years from the late 1960s to about 1974. It came about in a number of facets. One was in string theory back in the around 1970. People wanted to introduce fermions into string theory, and Ramond and others introduced a type of supersymmetry onto a world sheet. Various Russian physicists introduced nonlinear realizations of supersymmetry in the early 70s. But it was in 1974 that Wess and Zumino wrote down the first four-dimensional linear realization of the SUSY quantum field theory, and I'll mention how that works in a little bit. But to get started, let me talk about some of the motivations for supersymmetry. One motivation is aesthetics. Since I mentioned that supersymmetry gives rise to super Poincaré algebra, nature seems likely to want to use the most general extension of the Poincaré group. If it uses the Poincaré group, you'd think it would use the super Poincaré group, that algebraic structure at some level. Another nice thing about it is it has much improved ultraviolet behavior as a quantum field theory over other theories that include scalars, because it turns out the scalar quadratic divergences will end up canceling due to the enhanced symmetry of this theory. That is, if you have loops with bosons in them, loops with fermions will cancel off the quadratic divergences, and so you don't get that quadratic divergency in your theory. If you want to link this all to the Higgs boson mass, then it seems to indicate that the supersymmetric particles that you would also have to predict would be on order of the weak scale or the TeV scale. Supersymmetry also offers a connection to gravity. Namely, if you make a supersymmetry transformation as a local transformation, then naturally you introduce something called supergravity, and supergravity theory includes in the classical limit Einstein's general relativity. Since these theories are well behaved in the ultraviolet, you could imagine this type of theory, a supersymmetric theory extrapolating up to very high energy scales, and maybe you could find a theory that would be valid, for instance, all the way up to the gut scale. This is kind of a nice thing for many theorists, because it means that we might be able to do experiments at the TeV scale, and if we measure parameters at the TeV scale and the theory is valid all the way up to the gut scale, the TeV scale may have provide some sort of window to gut or string scale physics. And finally, there's a connection with superstring theory. In superstring theory, you have something called world sheet supersymmetry. And in many of the realizations of string theory, you get out as a consequence space-time supersymmetry as well. So it seems to have a lot of motivations on the theory side, but there's also a variety of motivations on the experiment side. And the first of these is gauge coupling unification and the connection to grand unified theories. Okay, at left, the gauge couplings, alpha 1, alpha 2, and alpha 3, have been measured to high precision. And once you know those gauge couplings at the Z scale, this is the energy scale Q here on a logarithmic scale. I hope the people in the far back can see the bottom of these slides. But if you extrapolate the gauge couplings to high energy via renormalization equations, in the standard model, they look like they're headed in the same direction, but they don't quite meet at a point. If instead you put in supersymmetry, then the beta functions of which govern how the coupling constants evolve actually change, and then you find that, in fact, these couplings all do meet at a point. And so that seems to be indicative of that maybe nature is described by some sort of supersymmetric grand unified theory. If you take a supersymmetric version of the standard model called the MSSM with two Higgs doublets, you get this gauge coupling unification. If you take the supersymmetric standard model and add in, for instance, extra Higgs multiplets, say four of them, then again you destroy the gauge coupling unification. And so this might be an indication that the MSSM, or minimal supersymmetric standard model, or the MSSM plus extra gauge singlets is the correct physical theory all the way from the weak scale up to the gut scale. In supersymmetric theories, it's quite natural to get out a cold dark matter particle. Usually these are the lightest neutralino, but it could be a gravitino or some other particles as well. But you can accommodate cold dark matter, which you can't do in the standard model. And here's a plot of the vacuum energy density and the mass density of the universe. Nowadays, you see that these all intersect, and the mass density of the universe should be around 25 to 30% of the closure density of the universe, which puts you right there. The standard model would say the mass density has to be over here, and that's not where all these data intersect. Another nice feature of supersymmetry is that whereas a standard model can accommodate a breakdown of electroweak symmetry, in supersymmetric models you actually have a derived mechanism for the breakdown of electroweak symmetry. Namely, if the P quark is extremely heavy, around 100 to 200 GeV, then it has a very big Yukawa coupling, and that Yukawa coupling pushes one of these Higgs squared masses down to negative values as you evolve masses from the unification scale to weak scale, and that causes the Higgs, the scalar potential, to have just the right form so that electroweak symmetry breaks and the W and Z and the standard model fermions get masses. That only works if you have a heavy top quark around 100 to 200 GeV, and that was predicted back around 1983, but later on the top quark was in fact found to have a mass of 175. More evidence is, well, in supersymmetric theories you have what's called decoupling of radiative corrections, as Tanabashi was mentioning, and the radiative, it looks like The tiny radiative corrections that you'd expect in supersymmetry agree with the measured electroweak constants if the Suzy particle masses are bigger than a few hundred GeV. Finally, the mass of the Higgs boson in the supersymmetric standard model, this thing is much more constrained than in the standard model. The SUSY Higgs boson, the standard model like, has to have a mass around 135 GeV or less. And as we saw from the previous speaker, the most probable value is that, in fact, it is quite light. And that's the slide that was showed previously. Finally, there's mechanisms for baryogenesis within the supersymmetric standard model. In fact, there's three different ones. Electroweak baryogenesis, which is barely alive. Leptogenesis, which is linked with neutrino masses, and Affleck-Dyne baryogenesis. And then finally, neutrino masses. Nowadays, we know that neutrinos have mass, and the most elegant way to give neutrinos mass is something called the seesaw mechanism. In that mechanism, you've got one extremely high mass scale, which pushes the right-handed neutrinos up to extremely high values so that you don't see right-handed neutrinos, but it also pushes the left-handed neutrinos very tiny masses. And if you want to accommodate this vastly different mass scale, then you need something like supersymmetry to stabilize the vastly different mass scales. So, to quote Altobelli, if we consider the main classes of new physics that are currently being contemplated, supersymmetry is the most directly related to grand unified theories. It offers a well-defined model, computable up to the Guff scale, and is actually supported by the quantitative success of gauge coupling unification in SUSY Guffs. For many other examples, contact with Guffs is lost, or at least much more remote, and these authors feel the SUSY picture remains the standard way beyond the standard model. So that's hopefully some motivation to take this seriously and look at what the implications might be for upcoming experiments like the LHC. Well, to get started, let me tell you about the first supersymmetric model, the four-dimensional quantum field theory that was written down, namely the Wess-Zimino toy supersymmetric model from 1974. Wess and Zimino wrote down a quantum field theory that had a rather simple Lagrangian. It had a kinetic term and a mass term. Kinetic term looked like this. A here is a real scalar field, and B is another real scalar field. Psi here is a spinner field, but it's the Majorana spinner field. A Dirac spinner field has four components in the Dirac spinner. The Majorana spinner has a condition, it has a constraint equation here, namely that psi is equal to C psi bar transpose. This is the Majorana condition. And that tells you, that constraint tells you that only two of the four components in psi are actually independent. And so you basically have two components here and two components here. And then there's two more things, F squared and G squared here. These things are called auxiliary fields. And they're not propagating fields because they don't have any kinetic terms with derivatives in them like these other fields here. But they're put in order to write supersymmetry transformations easily. In fact, they have mass dimension equal to 2, and they could be eliminated from this Lagrangian by using the Euler-Lagrange equations. If you apply the Euler-Lagrange equations to this Lagrangian, you find that F equals minus mb and G equals minus ma. You can get rid of them, or you can leave them in if you have to do some of the supersymmetry algebra. So this simple Lagrangian, what Wess and Zimino noted, was that if you take this simple Lagrangian and you do a transformation, you let the field A go to A plus delta A, where delta A is I times alpha bar gamma 5 psi. So psi is a Majorana spinner. Alpha bar is a set of parameters of the transformation, and they're arranged again into a Majorana spinner. So this is just a spinner set of parameters here, alpha bar, gamma phi, psi. But note that the field A transforms into itself plus a piece that now has a fermion field in it. And so the boson field is getting transformed to have a fermion component. Likewise, the B field also gets a fermionic component. And the spinner field psi gets transformed to have a bosonic component that's got A and B in it here. And then you also write down a transformation for those auxiliary fields, F and G. F goes to F plus delta F, which is I alpha bar D slash psi. So it picks up a fermionic component, but the important point to note is that it's a total derivative, because it's got this D slash in there. And likewise, G goes into a total derivative. So what these gentlemen noted was that they could do some algebra on that Lagrangian, input these transformations. These are infinitesimal transformations, so you can take these alphas as infinitesimal parameters, and see how the Lagrangian changes. It turns out that the Lagrangian's not invariant under this transformation, but instead it goes to a Lagrangian plus delta L, where delta L is a total derivative. Delta L for the kinetic term is d mu times all this garbage over here, and for the mass term, delta L is L mass plus this total derivative. Now, the Lagrangian may not be invariant. However, the fundamental quantity in quantum field theory is not the Lagrangian, but it's the action. And the action, remember, is the integration of the Lagrangian over d4x. And that action is invariant because if you look at the four-dimensional version of Gauss's law, the integration over a volume of a total derivative turns out to be a four-vector dot product evaluated on the bounding surface. And so if these fields are zero at spatial infinity, then this term goes to zero. And so the this West-Umino transformation here turns out to be a symmetry of the action of the theory. And so this is a symmetry, and it's different from many other symmetries that you've thought about because, in fact, the action is invariant even though the Lagrangian is not. Now, some of the nice features of this model is you can go ahead and what I wrote down so far on the previous page only had kinetic terms and mass terms. You can also add interaction terms, a coupling constant G, coupling the real field A to psi bar psi, and B to psi bar gamma phi psi, and you can get the trilinear interactions of the auxiliary fields with the scalar fields. And it takes a rather difficult calculation, but you can also show that this term goes to a total derivative as well. And once you have the interaction pieces here, then you can calculate scattering amplitudes. And lo and behold, if you calculate scattering amplitudes using this interaction Lagrangian, you find that all the quadratic divergences cancel out, whereas in theories without the supersymmetry, they do not cancel, and they generally hang around the theory and cause trouble. So that was a lovely property of these theories. If you express the supersymmetry transformation in terms of a generator Q, then you can calculate that these generators obey anti-commutation relations. The generators of the Poincaré group obey all commutation relations, but the supersymmetry transformations obey anti-commutation relations. QA, QB bar anti-commutator goes into 2 gamma mu. P mu, for P mu is the generator of translations. And you see here why I call these supersymmetry generators as sort of the square root of a translation, because if you do 2 of these, you get a translation. Okay, so that's a West Umino toy model, and that illustrates some of the nice properties of supersymmetry, namely that it does mix fermions and bosons, and you do get theories where you can cancel off all the quadratic divergences, and you only are left with logarithmic divergences. So the ultraviolet behavior of this type of theory is much better than you'd get in a theory like the standard model. Incidentally, since I'm from America, you have to have an advertisement in the talk. A lot of this material is in a new book called Weak Scale Supersymmetry, From Superfields to Scattering Events. And it's out this last spring from Cambridge University Press. It's an attempt to make supersymmetry accessible to experimental colleagues. And for that reason, part one is the theory part of the book. It does superfield calculations and Lagrangians using four component spinners, which should be familiar to many experimentalists from their Feynman diagram classes. Most other books will use two component spinners, and you have to learn a little bit more about how theorists operate. But these try to do everything in terms of known nomenclature, and it derives what's called a master Lagrangian for supersymmetric gauge theories. The middle part of the book is all about supersymmetric model building, including the MSSM, supergravity, and grand unified theories. And then the last part of the book is all about supersymmetry at colliders, how you calculate superparticle production mechanisms, decay rates, event generation, collider signatures, and hopefully it'll get people ready for the coming LHC years, especially if supersymmetry gets discovered at the LHC. Okay, so let's get back to constructing supersymmetric models. While the West Zumino model itself is quite interesting, West and Zumino essentially took the model out of a hat. They were able to construct it by playing around and working out what the Lagrangian would have to look like in order to get a symmetry that mixes fermions and bosons. And so they are able, after a lot of hard work, to write down even that simple Lagrangian to get the right form. However, it doesn't provide any rules about how to construct supersymmetric models in general. So shortly after West and Zumino had written down their theory in 1974, in 1975, Salam and Strozzi developed something called superfield formalism, and that type of formalism does give general prescriptions for writing down supersymmetric models in all sorts of different cases. And in fact, it allows you to write down a supersymmetric version of the standard model. So what Salam and Strozzi did was they wanted to somehow, since supersymmetry is going to mix fermions and bosons, what they wanted to do was somehow have one type of field that contained both fermions and bosons as different pieces to it. And that new type of field they called a superfield. In order to write down superfields, they found that they could write down those types of entities if they would expand the ordinary four-dimensional Minkowski space-time denoted by a four-vector x mu to something called superspace, where they have not only these four dimensions that we know and love, but now there's going to be four more dimensions, theta sub a. These are going to be arranged as a Majorana spinner, but each component of that Majorana spinner is something called an anti-commuting Grossmann value number. So a Grossmann number means that if you have theta 1 multiplied by theta 2, then that's equal to minus theta 2 multiplied by theta 1. So in fact, you have to add in four anti-commuting dimensions. So this is called superspace because instead of four dimensions, now you have to go to eight dimensions. You've got four commuting dimensions and four anti-commuting dimensions. And whether these dimensions are real or not, they're not sort of dimensions that you could walk into, or they're not the large extra dimensions that many models recently are talking about, but there's some sort of extra dimension at the quantum level, and their manifestation could be that you would get out what are called supersymmetric particles. Okay. So, Salam and Skrovsky were able to introduce several different types of superfields. One was called a general superfield. These things have little hats on them, so there's a phi and a hat, and it's a function of the x mu coordinates and also the theta coordinates. But the way they could combine spinner and scalar fields into this one entity was that this thing would have a scalar field as one component, then it would have these anti-commuting Grassmann dimensions, theta bar, multiplied by a spinner field psi, and that way the theta bar psi, in this case it's theta bar gamma 5 psi, is combines to make a Lorentz scalar, pseudo-scalar quantity that can be added to this scalar, and now you've got something that's got a scalar and a spinner field. When they expanded this type of field, they had to add other fields in. There was an M and an N field, and a V mu, this could be a vector field, multiplying other bilinears in terms of these superspace coordinates. And there were ultimately other things, a lambda field and a D field. And so they combined all these in this fashion, and that way they could combine both spinner and scalar fields together along with the vector fields into a single entity. It turns out these general superfields are not what you'd call an irreducible representation, but they can be reduced more, and in fact one way is to collapse this thing down to something called a left chiral scalar superfield. This type of thing, called S hat sub L stands for left, has a scalar component, a spinner component, and then an auxiliary field on it. And that's all it has. And then along with left chiral scalar superfields, there's right chiral scalar superfields, which has a scalar field, a psi right, so this would be a spinner field multiplied by the right projection operator, and a auxiliary field. Salam and Skrovsky found that these superfields had multiplication rules, namely two left chiral scalar superfields multiplied together gave you another left chiral scalar superfield. Two rights gave you another right, but if you multiply a left times a right, then you've got one of these big fat general superfields. And the important point about all this stuff is that this guy here, D, this is one of the auxiliary fields. It actually transforms the D term. This thing is called a D term of a general superfield. It actually transforms under a supersymmetry transformation into a total derivative. And likewise, the F term of a left chiral scalar superfield, this guy right here, under supersymmetry transforms into a total derivative. And what that means is that Salam and Skrovsky said, well, if I make any sort of new left chiral scalar superfield that's a product of all these other ones, then that could actually be a candidate for a Lagrangian because it's something that transforms into a total derivative. So they were able to come up with rules that allowed them to write down supersymmetric Lagrangians in general for any type of a quantum field theory. And it turns out that these supersymmetric Lagrangians, once they were able to write down these things, they found that supersymmetric Lagrangians only depended on two types of functions, One was called a superpotential F hat. This thing is a function of left chiral scalar superfields only, so it's going to itself be a left chiral scalar superfield, and that means its F term transforms into a total of derivative, and so its F term is a candidate Lagrangian. And then there is another type of function called a Taylor potential, K, which was basically a function of a left chiral scalar superfield times a right chiral scalar superfield. So it was a general superfield, and its D term was a candidate Lagrangian. So those two things allowed them to write down general Lagrangians for supersymmetric gauge theories. For gauge theories, they also had to introduce some extra superfields, something called a gauge superfield, which would have a vector field in it and then a lambda field. This is called a gaugino, and then a D term. This can be either written down as in this form or another form, including F mu nu. But using these various fields, then you can write down a master formula for supersymmetric gauge theories. Okay, now it takes many pages to derive this stuff, and I don't have enough time in this lecture to go ahead and derive the answer, but I can write the answer down on single transparency. And so this equation here is what's called the master formula for supersymmetric gauge theories. This is the result of all Salam and Strozzi's superfield formalism for theories with what's called global supersymmetry. And at this point, what they've done is they've eliminated all those Grassmann variables. So at this point, you can forget that you ever heard of a theta variable if you want, because they were just used to derive this formula. But basically, the formula, the top line here, has all kinetic terms on it. It's got a kinetic term for a scalar field S. And so it's d mu S dagger, d mu S. These D's are big D's, which means that they're covariant derivatives under some sort of a gauge transformation. So you pick the gauge group. If you add scalar fields to it, then you have to add in a appropriate covariant derivative to operate on them. And likewise, there'll be kinetic terms for the spinorial fermion fields here with their own covariant derivative. Then you'll have a kinetic term for the gaugino fields, these lambda bar fields. And then you have kinetic terms for the gauge bosons. The next line here that comes out has a scalar field multiplied by a gaugino field multiplied by a spinner field. So this would give something, it's got a coupling constant and a gauge group generator for whatever SUN gauge group you want, for instance. So this would do something like give you a quark Luino quark coupling, ultimately, in the minimal supersymmetric model. But it'll be related with certain coefficients and gauge couplings to quark gluon couplings, which would have the same gauge coupling right up here. The third line here has what's called the scalar potential of the theory. It has the superpotential in it, where you have to take derivatives of the superpotential with respect to superfields and square them, and then set the superfields equal to their scalar components. And then you get these things called D terms over here. And then finally on the bottom, you've got spinner bar multiplied by these derivatives multiplied by spinner terms. These actually give you Yukawa coupling terms in that you would get, for instance, in the standard model. So this, this formula, once you know how to use it, you can go ahead and use it to construct any supersymmetric gauge theory that you want. And you have to go ahead basically and plug in. You can't ignore any of these terms because every term is vital in order for this thing to have supersymmetry to it. And you have to plug in the proper covariant derivatives for the Majorana spinner fields and the gaugino fields And once you plug all this stuff in, you're guaranteed to have a supersymmetric Gates theory. Now, you can go ahead at this point and write down any supersymmetric gauge theory that you want. For instance, if you want supersymmetric QCD, you'd put in the gauge group SU3 color, and then you could plug in there. You'd have to have scalar fields, which correspond to quarks. You'd have to have spinner fields corresponding to quark fields. You'd have to have Gaugino fields corresponding to gluinos, and you'd have gauge bosons corresponding to gluons. But that type of theory would have perfect supersymmetry to it. And if you have a theory with perfect supersymmetry, that would be excluded phenomenologically because, for instance, we don't see any... it turns out that these quarks and sporks would have to have exactly the same mass, and we don't see any scalar quarks with the mass of the up quark or scalar leptons with the mass of the electron. So evidently, if supersymmetry is going to be phenomenologically viable, the supersymmetry has to be broken somehow. So this actually has to be a broken symmetry at energy scales that we observe with experiments today. It turns out that you can break supersymmetry spontaneously, just like you can break gauge symmetry spontaneously. The way you do it is to allow arrange for either these F terms or the D terms to have non-vanishing vacuum expectation values. But it turns out in a theory like the MSSM, if you try to break supersymmetry spontaneously, you rise into conflicts with the experiment. And so people usually break supersymmetry instead of spontaneously. They break it explicitly, and you can break supersymmetry explicitly by adding to the Lagrangian what are called soft supersymmetry breaking terms. These would be some additional terms to the Lagrangian that have a special form. They're called soft because they break the supersymmetry, but even though they break the supersymmetry, they do not reintroduce these the cancellation of quadratic divergencies, which is so important to the theory. So these soft supersymmetry breaking terms were cataloged, and it turns out there are only four types of terms here. Well, there's linear terms, which are relevant only for singlets of gauge symmetries. But more importantly, there's scalar mass terms, so all the scalars in theory could have a scalar mass, and that would break the supersymmetry. There are something called bilinear or trilinear terms. Namely, you take scalar fields and multiply them as bilinear or trilinear combinations. If these hat fields occur in the superpotential. And then finally, if you're in gauge theories, then Gaugino masses for each factor of the gauge group are allowed. And those are all the whole list of soft supersymmetry breaking terms that are allowed. Any other terms that you would add into Lagrangian would break supersymmetry in a hard fashion, and you'd get quadratic divergencies reintroduced into the theory. So at this point, now you can write down a recipe for supersymmetric model building, and we'll go ahead and use this recipe next time to write down a supersymmetric standard model of a supersymmetric grand unified theory. But the first step in the recipe is to go ahead and choose a gauge symmetry. And once you choose the gauge symmetry, for instance, SU2 or SU3 or a direct product group or something like that, then you have to adopt the appropriate gauge superfields for each gauge symmetry. Once the gauge symmetry is chosen, then you want to choose matter and Higgs representations, and then these matter and Higgs representations have to be included in the theory as left chiral scalar superfields. Step three in the recipe is you have to write down a superpotential. This is just a polynomial, but it has to be an analytic function of the left chiral scalar superfields. And if you honor a normalizable period, it has to have a degree less than or equal to 3. So it could be, for instance, squared terms or cubed terms, but you can't go beyond that if you honor a normalizable theory. And then, of course, it has to be gauge invariant too, which, again, restricts this type of thing. At this point, you can go ahead and plug all this into the master Lagrangian, and you'd have a supersymmetric gauge theory for whatever gauge symmetry you choose. And at this time, you can adopt all allowed gauge invariant soft supersymmetry breaking terms if you want to break the supersymmetry. And these are basically chosen to, philosophically, they're chosen to parameterize our ignorance of the mechanism of Susie's breaking. And next lecture, I'll talk about one mechanism to break supersymmetry at a more fundamental level, which is called supergravity breaking. But at this point, the master formula, supplemented by the soft Susie breaking terms, gives the final Lagrangian of the theory. And at this point, you can write down the full Lagrangian for any supersymmetric gauge theory with soft supersymmetry breaking, and then go ahead and calculate from there. Find what the physical states are and what their interactions are, and calculate scattering processes, for instance. Okay, so that's the situation. I want to stop here for today, and that constitutes an introduction to supersymmetry. Let me just give you a preview of the next lecture for tomorrow. In the next lecture, we're going to go ahead and use the master formula, plug in the gauge symmetry of the standard model, along with the standard model fermions, and we can write down what's called the minimal supersymmetric standard model. The MSSM includes the standard model as a sub-theory, but it includes a lot more. There's a lot of extra physical states that exist as well. Since the quadratic divergencies cancel, the MSSM could be a theory that's valid all the way from the weak scale up to the gut scale. And in fact, the weak scale and the grand unified scale could be linked with renormalization group equations. And I'll tell you how to calculate the superparticle mass spectra. I'll say some words about supergravity and then grand unified theories, SU5 and SO10. Okay? Thank you.
Merci. No question? Hello, Cassie. Let's thanks you.